Okay.
Okay. I guess we better get going. I wasn't given a lot of guidance about what to say, so I took it upon myself to, since this is a reunion, I thought I ought to say something about the past as well as the science. So I asked for, from Anne Dickinson, I want to thank her for this photograph. This is the Yale Department in 1978. This was the year that I graduated. And I don't know if you can say a lot about the department from a formal photograph like this. There's a lot of facial hair, which I suppose among you might ascribe to the 1970s, but indeed, Earth Science departments have always had a lot of facial hair, and that continues, so I'm not sure you can really say that much about it. So I was trying to think of something else that I might say about student life during the 1970s, and I got that time an email from Jeff Park, and he told me about a Yale tradition that had been revived recently. So I thought I would talk about that. And as part of this tradition, students would gather on the old campus, they'd lock arms, they would scream, and they would run at each other at full speed. And the numerous injuries that you might have thought would have ensued from this were mitigated by the large amounts of alcohol that were being consumed. And you have to understand that at the time, the drinking age was 18, so this was all perfectly legal. What I'm talking about, of course, is a bladder ball. And shortly after I left Yale, the sport was banned by President Giamatti for rather obvious reasons. The game would spill out. It couldn't be confined to the old campus, and injuries were quite common. And when it spilled out on the streets, if there were any drivers that were, you know, trying to drive to work or something like that, and were their cars would get stuck in this, and the students would just walk on top of the cars, which didn't do a lot for town gown relations at the time. And for example, there's a driver stuck in the crowd. He seems a little bit resigned to the situation. Okay, well, enough of bladder ball. One of the things that I spent a lot of time when I was at Yale doing was trying to figure out what classes to take. We used to have this thing called the Blue Book that had a list of all the courses, and I would spend a lot of time studying that, trying to figure out what classes to take. There was also a book that had reviews of the classes that you could use. And I want to mention two classes that I chose on the basis of their reviews. The first one, I'm sure a lot of you took, was taught by Brian Skinner. And I don't actually remember the title of it, but anyway, it was the introductory geology class. Thank you, Brian. And I took this class my sophomore year. You know, this was a great class. This was a class that made me decide to be a geology major. And anyway, I have to thank Brian for that. One of the things that appealed to me about the field was that you could do science, but you could also spend a lot of time outdoors. You know, you could do that sort of thing. The irony situation, at least for me, is that I spent almost all my time in front of a computer screen. But fortunately, there was another class that I took at Yale. It was another a great class. It was taught by Bill Bennett. It was called The Computer as a research tool. This was kind of a new class at the time, and it was the idea that you could actually use computer itself to solve problems in the sciences. And more than that, you could have a lot of fun doing that. And actually, I'm still having fun. I spend most of my time in front of the computer screen, and I write computer programs to look at data and things, but I have a lot of fun doing it. Okay, is that better? Okay. Okay, so to switch to science, the title is Seismology and the Mantle. Those are two rather large subjects. What, in fact, can we say about the mantle using seismology? In the last 10 or 20 years, seismologists have gotten quite good at producing these color views of the mantle, where red is for the slow regions and blue is for the fast regions. But what have we learned from these images? Well, one of the things I think we've now resolved is this thing that has been going on for a long time, this question of the whole mantle versus the layered mantle convection. And this is from a picture that I stole off the web, but you can see on the left a very simple view of whole mantle convection, where you have these large cells that convect like this. And this traditionally was favored by the geodynamic community. And then on the right, we have a strictly layered model where you have two cells, one in the upper mantle and one in the lower mantle. And this tradition was favored by the geochemists. And the critical thing in here is the role of the 660-kilometer discontinuity, whether it is a barrier to flow that causes the mantle to be strictly segregated into the two parts. So I think now we have a view of what's going on from seismology. This is one of Rob Vanderhill's slides from a few years back, and you can see that when you look at the slabs, the subducting slabs shown in blue, that in some cases they seem to go through, in some cases they seem to be deflected at the 660-kilometer discontinuity. Also, if you look at the topography on the 660-kilometer discontinuity, you can see that it's depressed in these regions associated with subduction zone, and that is consistent with a cold slab material pooling in the transition zone. So the view that we now have is close to this cartoon shown here, which is not really the same as either of the two end member models. It does involve some mass exchange between the upper and lower mantle because the slabs do eventually go through, but it's not where you have the simple cells like this. There is some resistance to flow at 660, and the nature of the flow changes at 660. So I think there's generally a consensus among geophysicists that we have something like this going on. There's not really a consensus as to what to call it. This is from Paul Tackley's paper last year. He called it intermittent or partially layered convection. One of the things, though, that I've noticed is that those who in the past favored the whole mantle convection model will say that they're right because this involves some kind of flow through the whole mantle, so they'll say this model vindicates whole mantle convection, and those who favored the layered convection in the past will say, no, this doesn't look like the whole mantle scenario because you have some degree of layering, so they'll call this a layered convection and say that the whole mantle convection people were wrong. I think now, though, we're getting to a dispute as to what to call it. rather than what it actually is. So it's not a very interesting dispute in that sense. There's some that have continued to argue for the idea that there should be a strict separation between a reservoir in the upper mantle and a reservoir in the lower mantle. I like to call these things stealth discontinuities, because they're proposed in such a way that they would be very hard to see seismically. They involve a small compositional density change, and the result is you get large amounts of dynamic topography. So Jean Lowe proposed one a long time ago where this sort of boundary would roughly coincide with the 660. More recently, Louis Kellogg and others proposed one in the mid-mantle. The most definitive result, I think, that shows that that's wrong was the paper that Paul Tackley wrote in 2002, where he did a numerical simulation of convection and showed that if you had such a boundary that you'd get a boundary layer would form there, which would concentrate heterogeneity, and you would then almost certainly see seismically. And there have also been more direct seismic tests for this hypothesis. Tomography, I think we're running short on time. I'm going to skip that one. One thing, too, you want to bear in mind when you look at the tomographic views of the mantle is that what you see depends to a large extent upon the inversion algorithm that you use, in particular the degree of regularization or smoothing that's applied. So you can have the same data set, and if you lightly smooth it, you'll get smaller, higher amplitude anomalies, and if you more heavily smooth it, you get larger, more low amplitude anomalies. So given this, are there things that we can say for sure that we've learned from mantle tomography? And there's a few things. We know that the velocity heterogeneity is strongest at the very top and the very bottom of the mantle. We know that some slabs do indeed go through the 660, but they tend to pond or buckle when they go through. Plumes are harder to see, and the evidence for plumes below 660 is right close to the edge of the current seismic resolution. Having said that, there's some new experiments that will probably have the results within a few years that I think will start to resolve this question. And finally, if you look at the ratio of the P velocity to the S velocity, this gives you a clue as to whether what you're seeing is a purely thermal effect, that is, that the slow velocities are slow because they're warm, or whether there's a compositional thing going on. And one of the more definitive results that's come out recently is that there is a compositional changes in the lowermost mantle. And the evidence for that is when you look at these models and you compare the shear velocity changes, for example, in the lowermost mantle, you get these fast velocities around the Pacific and then slow velocities in the central Pacific. If you compare this to the bulk sound speed model, which is what is directly sensitive to the bulk modulus, see it's actually fast in the central Pacific. So that's not a thermal effect. That requires there be some degree of compositional heterogeneity. And this gets at the question of what could be causing this. This is from an AGU talk of a few years ago. Francis Alvarez says that up to 50% primordial material may be present in the mantle. If you look at the mixing calculations that have been done, they show that heterogeneity, that is, chemical heterogeneity, is likely present in the mantle at all scales. And that sort of leads to this old idea that there might be a plum pudding model of the mantle. This is from a Jeff Davies slide. It's a little obsolete in the sense that it still has these sort of full convection cells without anything changing at the 660. But the idea is that you have a chemical heterogeneity at all scales because this doesn't completely mix. When we turn to comparisons to seismology, at the very large scale, we can produce these maps of fast and slow regions. We also can look at the very small scale, it turns out, because of the scattering we have of high-frequency waves. And that actually requires that we have small-scale heterogeneity in the mantle, the order of 5 to 10 kilometer scale length. It's small enough that there's no way that it's thermal, because any thermal anomaly would have diffused away. So we know that there's compositional heterogeneity very small scales. We know it's present, at least in the lower mantle, at very large scales. One of the questions I think we have to answer is what is going on at the intermediate scales, and that's kind of that's a challenge for seismology. We can get at that in two ways. We can take the tomography models and try to go to higher resolution, and that's going to be possible in some places where we have dense station coverage. So, for example, the U.S. Array experiment, many of you are familiar with, is starting to produce higher resolution tomographic images. And then the second way that we may be able to go is to push the scattering observations to longer periods and scales, and that's going to give us an idea of what the heterogeneity scale length is across there. And one of the things we hope this will do is facilitate some more quantitative comparisons to the models of geochemical mixing. Thank you.